my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Here we are at the Guy James Show, coming to you today live from the beautiful blue waters and sandy beaches of Southwest Florida. Albeit considerably subdued today. And you know why. I wouldn't have to tell everybody why we are subdued today. It is a sad day for America. It is a sad day for Democrats everywhere. It's a sad day for people who have fought and championed the disadvantaged, the poor. It's a sad day. And forgive me, please, because I have no words to adequately describe how I feel today. I really don't. And I know that most of you have similar feelings. The death of Senator Ted Kennedy is just overwhelming, because his passing not only represents the loss of a mortal man, but perhaps the death of a set of ideals that lives within the hearts of not nearly enough of our fellow men and women in this country. The death of Ted Kennedy is a blow to all who suffer the indignities of poverty and unfair practices against the working men and women of the nation, and it's a huge blow to those who desperately need health care. Health care that's doled out equally to our fellow Americans, regardless of their financial station in life. Ted Kennedy was born into wealth. He was, as everyone knows, a man of privilege. He was a man who was most assuredly not perfect, both in his private life and in his public life. And although he had wealth and power, I believe his dedication to those who suffer from injustice and poverty and ill health was second to none. His entire public career was dedicated to the poor and to the disadvantaged. He truly was the last lion of the United States Senate. It's said that almost everyone in the Senate loved him, whether they be across the aisle or wherever they may be politically, but they loved him as a man who could compromise, could reach across the aisle, could get things done, and did get things done so many times and in so many ways in the United States Senate. I don't think there's anyone that I can see in the Senate right now who can replace his zeal and his fervor for helping suffering American citizens. He was one of the great senators in our American history. I think there can be little doubt of that, if you're being fair. I am fortunate to have met him a couple of times and have a large picture of the two of us together smiling, and I'm not one to fawn over famous people, but Ted Kennedy is one of my heroes. I make no secret of that. I never have. Our nation's going to miss him. Those who have vilified him and continue to do so on this day of terrible sadness know in their hearts that this was a good man, a man for all seasons, a man who never shrank from a battle, and a man who loved his country and fought to make her better and better. Ted Kennedy will live in the hearts of millions of Americans forever. And so now it becomes more important than ever for the United States Congress to pass a meaningful health care bill to fulfill the legacy of the man who never stopped fighting for health care for all. He started from almost day one in his Senate career way back in 1962. That was one of the first things out of his mouth, was talking about health care and better Medicare back in those days for the elderly. He spent his entire career trying to help those who can't help themselves. And the Democrats in Congress owe it to Senator Kennedy to pass such a bill in his honor. To do anything less would be a disgrace. And so I hope that Democrats will look at the career of Ted Kennedy and see what he laid on the line politically all his political life to try and do to achieve health care for those who don't have it. It was his mission. It was his goal. And if the Democrats have any guts at all, they'll fight for this. And I mean fight for it. I don't mean compromise the whole thing away. I mean stand and fight. Like I said, to do anything else would be a disgrace. It'd be an affront to his legacy. God bless Ted Kennedy. We're going to miss him in so many ways. Of course, this day will not go by without a lot of people. Saying what they will. Ted Kennedy, because of his proud legacy of being an old-time Democrat and able to meld into the modern-day Democratic Party as well and show new senators and senators that have followed in his path what being a United States Senator is all about. It is about being wise and making deals and making compromise, reaching across the aisle. Something so few are able to do these days. The parties are so divided. Had there been more people like Ted Kennedy in the United States Senate right now, we would not be so divided. These men understood the gravity of this situation, some of these old-timers. They understood that they had to sit down at a table and come to a compromise for the American people. They understood that for the good of the American people, politics came in second, always. He didn't think about politics when he went in and cast a vote. He was thinking about his constituency. He was thinking about the people of Massachusetts. He was thinking about all of the people in the United States, not his political fortunes. Would that all senators and all representatives would feel the same way. We knew this was coming for a long time, and I've dreaded this for a long time. And just this past week, we heard that Teddy asked the legislature in Massachusetts to name an interim senator. I don't know who it will be. I do know this. It won't be anybody with the skills, the political skills that he had. It won't be anybody with as much compassion as he had for those with less advantage than himself. No one could have as much compassion for those that had less than himself than Ted Kennedy. He showed that throughout his 46 years in the United States Senate, and as I've mentioned before, was not a perfect man. Who amongst us is? He had things wrong in his private life that went very wrong. He had tragedy in his private life that few have ever endured. Can you imagine being from a family like the Kennedys and losing your older brother in the war? And then having your next older brother assassinated in the streets of Dallas, Texas. And then having another brother, your other older brother, assassinated in the kitchen of a restaurant and of a hotel in Los Angeles, California. His life was filled with tragedy. And yet he overcame it all. He had bumps in the road all along the way. And yet somehow he was man enough to pass the test. And he did pass it. I think Ted Kennedy would want us to fight on for this health care bill. He's immortal now. He's died. And he would want us to see that his last and greatest wish was carried out. So that all of us will be represented in the most important legislative vote of our lives. He fought for this health care prize his entire career. Rest in peace, Ted. The dream shall never die. And there's an old Hamlet piece that said, "Now cracks a noble heart. Good night, sweet prince. And flights of angels sing thee to thy rest." We'll talk a lot about Ted Kennedy and his legacy today. We have a couple of guests with us today that'll touch on a couple of other subjects. We're going to talk to a gentleman in about a half hour or so about how, once again, giant corporations are pushing a little guy out of the way. Oddly enough, in Ted Kennedy's backyard almost. And a little later on in the day, we'll be talking to John McCary, former U.S. Army interrogator in Iraq, who points to recently released CIA reports as yet more evidence that torture does not work and must not be tolerated. Something else that Ted Kennedy abhorred. On this day of sadness for so many of us, there also comes much hate into our lives and to the media. As we find that Ted Kennedy is going to be buried in Arlington National Cemetery, where he has every right to be buried, both as an Army veteran and both as a United States Senator. He will be buried near his fallen brothers and have one of the most beautiful views of Washington, D.C. that one could ever have standing there on that hill. If you've stood on that hill, and I have many times, you would understand why somebody in public life would pick that spot. Looking down at the mall, at the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Memorial, and now the Second World Memorial, and ultimately the Capitol Building. A great honor for a public servant to be in that position. We'll be back in just a few minutes, okay?
Just imagine if the health insurance lobby took the $1.4 million a day they were spending to fight health care reform and spent that money lowering patient cost. Just imagine if the drug companies spent the $120 million they're about to spend on advertising to fight health care reform, and they spent that money making life-saving drugs more affordable. Just imagine an American healthcare system that wasn't run by huge profit-making companies wasting millions of dollars on lobbying and ads and CEO pay. Can you imagine? Because that's what healthcare reform looks like. This message created by Lee Stranahan. I'm an uninsured father taking on the health insurance industry.
Welcome back, everybody.
The Media Matters.
It's good to have all of you along with us this afternoon on this very, very sad day in America. As I mentioned before, there are people who don't think it's so sad. Many times I have pointed out hatred. And I mean the most vicious, vile, horrible kind of hatred that comes from the right. And today, there are many classic examples of what I've spoken about. First of all, if somebody can confirm this for me, I wish you would. I am told by a friend in Dallas, Texas, that the flags are not flying at half-mast. Can any of you confirm this for me? I hope someone can. Of course, there are right-wing websites around that are spewing the most vile kind of hatred that I've ever heard. Not that that's anything new, not that that's anything unusual, but I would think that one for one day they might be able to give it a rest. But sadly, no. Let me give you a few of these posts, a couple from the Free Republic. Here's a couple from the Free Republic. And I quote, "I feel no more sorrow or sympathy for Ted Kennedy than I did for Saddam Hussein. Kennedy was one of the real enemies, foreign and domestic, that I swore to defend our Constitution from." It's from Eric on the Free Republic. There's another one from Major Maturity on Free Republic. "The man was a failure and worse, a liberal. Rotten in hell, Teddy." And another one writes, what, "The landfills in Massachusetts are full?" It is hard for me to understand hatred like this. I know it is for many of you as well. I don't get it. There have been many people that I didn't like in public life. But on the day they died, we didn't have to say things like this about them. Ted Kennedy said not so long ago concerning health care, "This is the cause of my life. For four decades, I've carried this cause from the floor of the United States Senate to every part of this country." It has never been merely a question of policy. So it goes to the heart of my belief in a just society. Ted Kennedy was a great man, had his problems. I know that the name Chappaquiddick will come up many, many, many times on right-wing websites this weekend, and on Fox News and all over the place. That'll be what's remembered most by people on the right. That's definitely what they'll remember the most on the right about Ted Kennedy. But you won't hear them say very much. about some of the things that Kennedy got done. And there's a list of things a mile long that Ted Kennedy got done for this country and for the people of this country. Gender equality. Gender equity. Kennedy saw the Senate of the Equal Rights Amendment in 1972, which aimed to make men and women equal in the Constitution. He reintroduced the legislation against this congressional session, but it's yet to make it into the Constitution. Kennedy championed Title IX of the Civil Rights Act in 1972, which prevented educational institutions from discriminating against women. Every woman who's ever been associated with any sports in college, be it a small private college or all the way up to a huge institution like Ohio State University, every woman has to be thankful to Ted Kennedy. Stopping some of the discrimination against women in sports and other ways as well. And afterwards, colleges and universities integrated, paving the way for women like Sonia Sotomayor and Hillary Clinton to attend Ivy League institutions, along with the equitable athletic opportunities. Civil rights. Kennedy saw the passage of the Civil Rights Restoration Act of 1988 as committee chairman, which strengthened the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And afterwards, then executive director of the Leadership Council on Civil Rights, Ralph Nees, said, "Now you see what happens when you have a civil rights champion in charge of the committee." He wasn't called the Lion of the Senate for nothing. He was the chief sponsor on the Civil Rights Act of 1991, which addressed intentional discrimination and harassment in the workplace. He was also the key sponsor of legislation by the same name in 2008, which sought to restore civil rights protections stripped by Supreme Court rulings in recent years, like the Lilly Ledbetter case. Pay equity. Ted Kennedy worked on the Fair Pay Restoration Act, which sought to restore the rights of women to sue with each discriminatory paycheck, overturning the Supreme Court ruling in Ledbetter versus Goodyear. Voting rights. Kennedy worked on the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which allowed equal access to voting as part of the civil rights movement. He also worked to add amendments in 1982 that expanded voting access to Native Americans, to Latinos, and to others who required language assistance. He was a great champion of immigrants into this country. Affirmative action. Kennedy helped defeat legislation that would have ended federal affirmative action in 1998 and joined his colleagues in the Senate in a filing of a brief urging the Supreme Court to uphold affirmative action in 2003. LGBT rights. Kennedy's been the chief sponsor in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act since 1994, which would make it illegal to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation in the workplace. The bill has yet to pass, but that didn't stop him fighting for it. Hate crimes. Kennedy worked on the Matthew Shepard Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act in 2007, which would implement more severe penalties for crimes against women, gays, lesbians, and transgender persons. The bill was vetoed by President Bush in 2007, but the legislation has been reintroduced in the 110th Congress. Not very many people remember that Ted Kennedy was at the forefront of the battle against HIV/AIDS. Kennedy introduced what became the Ryan White Care Act, which addressed 13 cities hit hardest by the HIV/AIDS crisis in 1990. And when it was up for reauthorization in 2000, It provided nearly $9 billion in HIV/AIDS services over the following 5 years. This is more of the legacy of Ted Kennedy. Domestic violence. Kennedy worked with Vice President Joe Biden on the 1994 Violence Against Women Act. He also worked on its reauthorization in 2000, which allowed immigrant women to apply for permanent status in the United States without their abusive partners. Disability equality. He had disabilities in his own family, you know. And Kennedy worked to pass the Americans with Disability Acts in 1990, which provided much-needed accommodations for those with disabilities. The minimum wage. Kennedy worked with Congress in 2007 to pass the first hike in the minimum wage in more than a decade. Women disproportionately make up the population low-wage hourly workers. Women in combat. Does any other senator have a legacy like I'm talking about right now? If you know one, tell me. But there are none. Women in combat. Kennedy championed the repeal, a ban of women in combat in 1991. Women are still technically barred from fighting in the front lines, and such stipulations are meaningless in modern combat. By working for legislation that repealed the archaic legislation, Kennedy helped women achieve more equality in the military. Military child care. In 1989, again with children, Kennedy saw the passage of the National Military Child Care Act, which established the Department of Defense's child care program. This allowed working spouses of military members and women who were enlisted themselves to have access to high-quality, federally funded child care. The Republicans fought him tooth and nail on that bill, like the people in the military didn't deserve child care. Health insurance for children and pregnant women. In 1997, Kennedy co-sponsored the State Children's Health Insurance Program, the CHIP program, allowing families to have access to health care that previously did not. Ted Kennedy also introduced legislation that has yet to pass, Affordable Health Care Act, which would expand Medicaid and CHIP coverage for children, pregnant women, and the disabled. He saw the passage of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act in 1978, which made it illegal for employers to fire women for leave taken due to pregnancy. We still don't require employers to provide paid maternity leave like they do in many other countries. Minority health care. Kennedy championed the Minority Health and Health Disparities Research and Education Act in 2000, which provided funding for research for how to reduce disparities in cancer, heart disease, HIV/AIDS, diabetes, and other severe health problems that are found to be significantly higher in minority populations. In 2006, he introduced the Minority Health Improvement and Health Disparity Elimination Act, which would address inequalities in health care, access, and treatment if passed. The inclusion of women in scientific and medical research. Kennedy co-sponsored the NIH Revitalization Act of 1993, legislation that called for the inclusion of women and minorities in federally funded clinical research. This is just a small list of the things Ted Kennedy accomplished in the United States Senate for those who need help, for those who are disadvantaged, for women, for minorities, for all ethnic groups, for immigrants. There has been no greater champion for the disadvantaged people in this nation ever than Ted Kennedy. Ever. Let's hear a few words from Ted Kennedy, coming from 1980.
Well, worked out a little different from the way I thought. But let me tell you, I still love New York. My fellow Democrats and my fellow Americans, I have come here tonight not to argue as a candidate, but to affirm a cause. I am asking you to renew the commitment of the Democratic Party to economic justice. I am asking you to renew our commitment to a fair and lasting prosperity that can put America back to work. This is the cause that brought me into the campaign and that sustained me for 9 months across 100,000 miles in 40 different states. We had our losses, but the pain of our defeats is far, far less than the pain of the people that I have met. We have learned that it is important to take issues seriously, but never to take ourselves too seriously. The serious issue before us tonight is the cause for which the Democratic Party has stood in its finest hours, the cause that keeps our party young and makes it, in the second century of its age, the largest political party in this republic and the longest lasting political party on this planet. Cause has been, since the days of Thomas Jefferson, the cause of the common man and the common woman. Our commitment has been, since the days of Andrew Jackson, to all those he called the humble members of society, the farmers, mechanics, and laborers. On this foundation, we have defined our values, refined our policies, and refreshed our faith. Now I take the unusual step of carrying the cause and the commitment of my campaign personally to our national convention. I speak out of a deep sense of urgency about the anguish and anxiety I have seen across America. I speak out of a deep belief in the ideals of the Democratic Party and in the potential of that party and of a president to make a difference. And I speak out of a deep trust in our capacity to proceed with boldness and a common vision that will feel and heal the suffering of our time and the divisions of our party. The economic plank of this platform on its face concerns only material things, but it is also a moral issue that I raise tonight. It has taken many forms over many years in this campaign and in this country that we seek to lead. The challenge in 1980 is to give our voice and our vote for these fundamental democratic principles. Let us pledge that we will never misuse unemployment, high interest rates, and human misery as false weapons against inflation. does pledge that employment will be the first priority of our economic policy. Let us pledge that there will be security for all those who are now at work, and let us pledge that there will be jobs for all who are out of work, and we will not compromise on the issues of jobs. These are not simplistic pledges. Simply put, they are the heart of our tradition, and they have been the soul of our party across the generations. It is the glory and the greatness of our tradition to speak for those who have no voice, to remember those who are forgotten, to respond to the frustrations and fulfill the aspirations of all Americans seeking a better life in a better land. We dare not forsake that tradition. We cannot let the great purposes of the Democratic Party become the bygone passages of history.
Hello?
Yes, I'm calling because I have a patient with your insurance plan. He suffered a severe leg wound, and we need to operate immediately.
Yes, first we require a referral from his primary care physician.
We have to act fast. He needs urgent care.
They all do, don't they? Let me check the plan. Okay, we cover that. But before we pay, the patient must first meet his $5,000 deductible. And there will be a $1,000 copay.
The patient can't afford that. Is there any procedure you cover entirely?
Yes. Isolating the wounds and applying a 3x8 centimeter sheath. Then applying slight pressure with the thumb and forefinger to secure the treatment with a mild adhesive gel.
You mean a Band-Aid?
Well, that's not what we call it. We call it health care.
Hey, fuck! Ain't it the truth? That's what they call health care. We're going to see in the next few days. We're going to see what kind of guts the Democrats in the House and the Senate have. We're going to see if they have the guts of Ted Kennedy. We're going to see if they will honor his legacy. We're going to see if they will stand and fight for a health care program that really means something, not just some token plan so they can say, gee, we passed something. No. Something that's got a public option in it, something that has some teeth in it, something that will help the millions of uninsured people in this country. It's a national disgrace. It absolutely is a national disgrace what we have right now. Oh, to be sure, we have great medical care in this country. We probably maybe have the finest in technology and all that. But the availability to the average citizen in this country, hey, let's face it, it's not even close to what it ought to be. It is a disgrace. It's a disgrace to a rich nation like ours, like us. I'm asking everybody today to fight a little harder for this. It's what we need to do. Fight a little harder for it. In case you're wondering about some of the hatred that's coming up today about Ted Kennedy, in case you're wondering how the people on the right think and how they act and about their civility and about their ability to understand politics as the art of compromise and how to understand what's decent and what's right in this country for all, let me read you a few clips from the Free Republic today. Kennedy was born into the Catholic faith like Hitler was too, but individuals such as these could hardly be considered to be real Catholics. Kennedy's going to be real shocked to see God's finger pointing toward either purgatory or hell, and even more so when he asks, where is the majority of his family, and God's eyes follow his finger. Ted may even follow with a, "You don't know who I am," and God will reply, "Yes, Ted, I do." Someone that knows the mind of God. Another writes, "Yeah, Teddy did all he could to destroy this country, and guess Obama can finish it." Another says they ought to cremate him and flush him down the toilet. Mm-hmm. These are Republicans. Another says Kennedy was a vile, untrustworthy pig who routinely violated his oath of office and who probably did more to destroy America than any single person in the last 100 years. These are the people that you and I try and argue with over this. These are the people whom your Glenn Becks and your Limbaughs and your Hannitys and your Michael Savages and all those people, these are the people they talk to every day. These are the people that they indoctrinate every single day, 24/7. We're going to take a quick break right now. I'm going to get our first guest on the line, and we'll be back in a moment or two. Okay, I think we have our guest on the line. Rich, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Rich. We had an odd thing going there. I was calling you, and you were calling me. Welcome.
Oh, that's
the... Timing was impeccable. Rich, welcome to the program. We wanted to have you on the Guy James Show today to explain something that is going on in the Northeast. Of course, there's a lot going on in the Northeast today, sadly. But... something that's going on in the Northeast that a lot of people are just not aware of, about the fishing business up there and about the little guys being just nosed out of their lifetime profession. First of all, Rich, am I butchering your name when I call you Canastra?
That was perfect.
Oh, well, hey, I'm off to a good start. And Rich represents the people up there in the fishing industry in the Northeast, Martha's Vineyard in that area. Rich, tell us about what you do and your concerns right now.
I am the owner of the Whalen City and the Boston Seafood Display Auction up in New Bedford in Boston, Massachusetts. And we also have SavingSeafood.com, which is a website where you can get information on what's going on in the industry in the Northeast. And what's happening is yesterday we had a friendly little protest with about 12 New Bedford vessels that we steamed from New Bedford into Vineyard Haven on Martha's Vineyard in protest of this cat share system that is more or less being force-fed to us come in May of 2010. And the reason why I'm saying it's force-fed is that everything's happened so quickly. It's happening so quickly. And the vessels have to make decisions before they actually know what their allocation would be on the groundfish, on which species they're able to catch and their limit they're able to catch. So that's more or less the protest. And with what we see in the future of the allocation we think we're going to be given, you can expect at least 400 vessels out of business by the end of 2010.
And these are people who didn't start this business yesterday, right?
No, exactly. A lot of them are third, fourth generation families that when their grandfather, great-grandfather came over from Europe, most of them are Portuguese immigrants, Norwegian, Irish, that came over from overseas that had the American dream and work hard and you'll get your small business, and now we're getting pushed out by NGOs and a Northeast Fisheries Service that is definitely not pro business.
Why are they being allowed to do this? What type of legislation has helped them push you out?
Well, it's all the thing of saving the fish, saving the oceans, and you know, being a fisherman, we are probably the most conservative and conservational friendly people out in the ocean. Now, let's face it, we got 4 to 5 generations of fishermen that have been passed this business on from their families. They don't want to see the oceans be raped or fishing the last species. They want to keep it profitable for their sons and grandchildren. And when we're being told with a crisis that, you know, the fish are going to be depleted if you don't do anything, it kind of causes an emergency, and Mr. and Mrs. Consumer kind of feel bad for the fish. They think that we are raping the oceans, and which we're not. Matter of fact, last year we threw over almost 1 million pounds of codfish that couldn't be landed because of regulations.
Explain to us how this catch share system works, if you will.
Well, the catch share, it's almost like an IFQ, which is an individual fishing quota. The West Coast, Alaska, and Seattle, they're on that system now, but it took them 10 years to develop it. And we're expecting to have this system up and running within 2 years, and there's still a lot of I's and a lot of T's, you know, that have to be dotted and crossed. And what a catch share is that you get an allocation over your last 10 years of fishing, that you go by your history. On the last 10 years, they'll divide that by 10, and it'll give you your actual history of what you landed. Now, that history will be divided into a percentage of how much you can catch per species on the total allowable catch that the scientists will give us to fish. Now, what's happened is that our allocation, a total allowable catch from this year fishing to next year fishing, almost dropped 50%. So no matter how good of a history you had, there's no fish to be caught because of a drastic reduction in the catch limits. For an example, if a boat has a history of 10 years of 1 million pounds of codfish, which give them 100,000 pounds divided by 10, with this reduction, they're only allowed to catch 40,000 pounds for 2010, and that's not feasible. And where boats would have to stay away from the fish in order to keep fishing.
Well, Rich, do you disagree vehemently then with the scientist and the government that says these fish are being fished out? That I've heard reports lately that that don't, you know, give the fish population in the area very much longer before they're fished out. What say you to those reports?
Well, what we actually see in the ocean is that there is a lot of fish out there. Now, how they come up with those figures is that they have vessels that that NOAA own. These are like 150, 200-foot vessels that are doing trawl surveys. Now, we take one of our New Bedford vessels and have it fish side by side with the NOAA vessel. We can catch 10 times as much species as they can. It's just because those vessels are not rigged to go fishing. And we've been saying this in the past, that every New Bedford vessel, we have about 400 in New Bedford, are floating laboratories. They're floating science studies. This put the scientists on our boats where we know how to fish and do your sampling then. Because if they're in an area when there's where there's no fish and they put down that there's no fish, it kind of looks like the species is not available and it's not of abundance. But you got to remember, if you're fishing during the daytime for flounder, you're not going to catch anything. You have to fish at night. It's a nighttime fishery. There's so many different factors that lay into fishing that, you know, these trawl surveys, they just don't take into account. So we don't blame the scientists at Woods Hole that are doing these stock assessments. We kind of blame the information that they're getting. And it's almost like a brain surgeon going into surgery, and then you give them a hammer and a chisel instead of the right tools to work with.
I see. So basically you're saying they're coming up with these graphs and charts and predictions for the fish population because, well, let's just say it how it is, because they don't know what they're doing about fishing. If they had you on board these ships to tell them where and when to fish, they'd probably catch more and think there are more fish in the sea.
Exactly. That's exactly true. And, you know, fish do swim around the ocean. There's so many closed areas in which the fishermen are not able to access, in which there's large populations of fish. You know, we went through this about 10 years ago with scallops. They were saying that the oceans were depleted of scallops, and it took, God bless him, Ted Kennedy, when he got funding for UMass Dartmouth, which is a local college in which they have a science center, marine science center, in which they did surveys with cameras showing them that there is more scallops in these areas. Well, today, it would be about in the last 4 or 5 years, the scallop industry is profitable. The biomass of scallops, they did their last survey a few months ago, and it came out to be that the stocks are in great shape, and we're pouring $1 billion into our local economy just through scallops and the species that we fish for, the fish species.
Well, Rich, are you telling us then in so many words that despite the increase in population in the world, that the fish can remain populated enough in the world's waters to still feed however many people may live on this planet without getting fished out?
I would have to speak of the Northeast and the areas in the grounds that I'm familiar with. They're very plentiful. In the 70s, we had big factory ships that came into New England before they put that 200-mile limit. And they would take thousands of metric tons of fish. And it's not even recorded of how much fish they took out of the ocean because there wasn't any information that we required from these ships to tell us how much fish they actually took from our waters. But every species back then that were caught in the ocean, none of them is depleted. None of them were depleted over the last 23 years. So it just shows that, you know, the stock is abundant, and it really cannot be depleted as far as fishing on that last fish. You know, there are some stocks that we avoid that we know that might have a problem, but when you're dealing with 18 different species in one ecosystem, you're always managing to the weakest link, meaning that if it's codfish that might be in trouble, that codfish is stopping us from getting haddock, which is very abundant. Last year, we caught 17% of our total allowable catch because a species like yellowtail flounder and codfish stopped us from accessing the healthier fish. So it should be ecosystem management, not single species management, and that's really what's hurting the industry today.
Chris, can you explain this 200-mile limit to us, please?
Well, I believe it was in 76 that we used to have big, before then, factory trawlers from Europe and in Japan used to come over, into our waters and just fish the heck out of our fish. Through international law, we put a 200-mile limit that no factory ship can fish within 200 miles of our shores. So this way, it will protect the species for the United States instead of having other countries rape our oceans.
How about the interest of the big moneyed interest in this, like LaFood Incorporated and some of those? How are they involved in this problem?
Well, a lot of the NGOs are involved in protecting the species only because it's a great buzzword today. You know, we're overfishing the ocean. 2 years ago is that we're cutting too much wood down in the forest, and whatever crisis there is, they'll jump on the bandwagon. We're concerned with these cat shares. That since the little guy won't be able to make it, that these licenses could be bought up by overseas companies or big corporations, in which they can bundle these small quotas, put them into a big quota, and have a factory ship fish for them.
Rich, how many people are we talking about whose livelihoods are threatened by this problem in the Northeast?
Just in New Bedford alone is 3,000. I'd say the total would be about 20,000 people.
Well, that's a significant number to be sure. And you're as sure can be that there is no danger in your area of overfishing it and depleting the ocean of all of its fish.
Personally, I really don't believe so, especially when we see how much fish these boats have to throw over today to be in regulations and not to have any fines against them. I see the older fishermen, they come in and they have tears in their eyes just seeing how much fish they have to toss overboard. Now the cat share system could help if it's run properly. It's just that they're not giving us enough fish to catch. With this cat share program, that it will be, it'll definitely be a failure.
Okay, well, Rich, we're up against the top of the hour. I want to thank you so much for coming on and explaining the problem. Do you have a website that people can go to and take a look at what's going on?
Yes, it's www.savingseafood.com or .org, and that's the project of Saving Seafood and Ocean Resources. Sources in which we sponsor up here in the Northeast.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for coming on and explaining this today. It's important to your area of the country and to the people who are the consumers that you satisfy with your great catch of fresh seafood. And we want to thank you very much for coming on. The website one more time?
It's www.savingseafood.com.
Savingseafood.com. Rich Canastra, thanks so much for being on the program today. We appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All righty, we're going to stop for news coming up at the top of the hour. We'll be back right after that.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Just when it's starting to look like the Great Recession is lifting, the Center for Economic and Policy Research is out with a report that shows working people will be suffering the recession's effects through 2014. Based on Congressional Budget Office projections, the report says we're facing what looks like a sustained period of low economic growth and high unemployment. Employment isn't expected to fully rebound from this recession until 2014. As a result, consumption, the driving force in the economy, will be reduced through 2014. Some 12 million people will remain jobless in 2010, according to the CBO analysis. It says investment losses through 2014 will amount to $600 billion. This means millions of people will be struggling for years to come to survive even as the economy emerges from recession. The Center for Economic and Policy Research says this demonstrates the need for continuing robust efforts to lower unemployment and stimulate economic growth even after the recession ends. Less money coming in has left 19 states looking at the furlough option to address budget constraints, Jesse Russell reports.
States continue to look for solutions to mend budget gaps. In Maryland this week, more than 200 state workers will be receiving layoff notices. The layoffs come on top of the remaining state workers taking furlough days. The Maryland furlough plan is tiered to account for the pay levels of workers. Workers that make more than $100,000 per year face the equivalent of a pay cut of 10 furlough days. The state is trying to overcome a budget gap of nearly $740 million. In Rhode Island, the state government plans to shut down 81% of the state's workforce for 12 days. Workers will not be paid for those days. The first shutdown day is scheduled for September 4th. Rhode Island has the second highest unemployment rate in the country at 12.7%.
The French government on Tuesday met with representatives from an Illinois-based electronic components plant in an effort to mediate a labor dispute. The U.S. company closed its French plant, and workers are demanding better severance packages. The company says workers injured an American manager during a protest against the plant's closure. Workers say they just pelted the boss with eggs. Workers have camped out outside the plant as they press their demands. Jesse Russell has today's economic report.
Consumers exuded a great deal of confidence in the economy in August, according to the Consumer Confidence Index released this week. The index found that an increasing number of consumers felt jobs would be easier to find in the coming months. The number who said jobs are hard to get declined from 48.5% to 45.1%. The number of consumers who see their situation improving over the next 6 months jumped by 10 points on the expectations index.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you're one of those people yelling at town hall meetings, I hate to break it to you, but you're a patsy. You may think you're trying to save America from the government, but you're really being used by the health insurance industry, who's using the government to keep their very profitable monopoly. The health insurance industry doesn't care about competition or freedom or patients' rights or you, for that matter. Stop yelling. Start thinking. This message created by Lee Stranahan. I'm an uninsured father taking on the health insurance industry.
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Please! Please, you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
You can count down. Six. Five, four, three, two, one.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. On this sad Wednesday. I guess we have reason to be sad, and we have reason to be happy and glad and joyous, as is in the case of when many people die. We think of the more sad aspects of it, but we forget to celebrate the goodness of their life and the achievements that they've made in their lives. And that's one thing I'd like to concentrate on for the rest of the day, the great things that Teddy Kennedy has done. And we'll do that after our next guest. And I would invite your calls after that. We're going to have a guest on in just a couple of minutes coming up. We're going to have John McCary. John is a former U.S. Army interrogator in Iraq. And we're, as you all know, these new stories coming out about Holder going after some of these people, perhaps, it's going to be interesting to see what comes up. Going to be interesting to see where the trail leads. Going to be interesting to see if it heads to the front door of Mr. Dick Cheney. Frankly, I must tell you, and I guess I'm not giving away any secrets here, it would please me to no end if it led to the front door of Mr. Dick Cheney. It really would. We're not going to take any calls here for the next minute or so. In fact, I think I will take this opportunity to go ahead and get our guest on the line here, if I may do so. And let me just do that while you're with us right here. It is live radio, after all. You know, if we had a huge budget here, we'd have somebody doing this for us. Let's see. Let's dial. Calling? Is it ringing? No. Here we go. It's trying to call. Well, what do you know about that? Let's try this again. Let's just try it again. Talk amongst yourself.
I'm Carrie.
Hi, John. It's Guy James from The Guy James Show.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome to the program. We're going to go live right now.
Okay.
We have with us right now John McCary, former U.S. Army interrogator in Iraq. And as you all know, well, and you don't know this, he was referred to us by the Truman National Security Project, and a great organization, and I thank them for that. And John, I thank you for coming on the program today to explain something that's been a real hot button in the news as of late, and, well, for a long time, really, but it seems like there's going to be some action on possibly some of the things that took place in Iraq involving detainees. Explain to us where we're at on this right now, if you can.
Well, it does look like there's a little bit of movement. Definitely it was not an anticipated move, and from some of the media reports, it doesn't look like it was a desired move for Eric Holder to move forward with the investigation and to reopen the investigation into some of the techniques that the CIA has been using in some of the previously undisclosed detention facilities. We chatted a little bit yesterday. I don't know if it's going to lead to anything, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. I was doing some research today just on some things that sort of piqued my curiosity, because we've definitely heard almost since day one in Afghanistan and later in Iraq about prosecutions and accusations, indictments, and then eventually convictions of U.S. military personnel for alleged and then proven abuses, right? And so I checked it up, and even as late as 2 or 3 years ago, there had been 85 court trials and something like upwards of 15 convictions. resulting in prison time, dishonorable discharge, extensive fines. So we have, a precedent for monitoring our own behavior under, very tense or, otherwise high risk, highly emotional situations. So I'd like to think that we can use that same sort of process for this situation. But for some reason, it seems like there's a massive sense of hesitation to do that when it regards the CIA as opposed to the U.S. Army.
Well, John, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you. You were there as an Army interrogator. What's the difference between the CIA and the Army's tactics? One allowed anything and the other didn't?
Yeah, well, it seems that way, or you could read it that way. I was a little surprised, to say the very least, at sort of one of the lead articles in the New York Times this morning that said, the Inspector General's report that came out yesterday, the New York Times said, painted a picture of strict control and extensive regulation by the CIA, remotely from the U.S. for its field agents across the world, and in particular with regards to detainees that were waterboarded, upwards of 80 and 180 times. And it just didn't make any sense to me. Saying that the CIA had tight control over its interrogations worldwide is like saying that, it's okay for your neighbor to build napalm in his basement because he read the Anarchist Handbook. I mean, just because you write it down how it's supposed to be, doesn't mean that that's the way they're going to do it. And in fact, that's very much not the case. So what seems to be lacking from the CIA process, and that's noted over and over again in the Inspector General's report, is any sense of accountability, any checks and balances, any verification that procedures are being followed. And now we're seeing a total lack of legal accountability, which just doesn't add up. I mean, when you're an interrogator or a human intelligence collector in the United States Army or the United States military and you go to these schools, the very first thing that they do is sit you down and teach you about the Geneva Convention. I mean, you don't even get to learn a skill or anything. Until you get briefed in that and tested on that. And then it's drummed into you over and over and over again. I mean, there are very strict rules regarding your behavior. Now, you can contrast that fact, right, the fact that you're taught not to even touch people, you can't say certain things, with the fact that, there have been multiple cases of, military interrogators conducting obviously egregious and unimprovable behavior, right? So the lesson, I think, from that is you set the standard somewhere, and you understand as an organization that people may deviate from that in either direction. And then you realize that that's the nature of, human nature and also the nature of combat and situations like that. And so then you put in institutional checks and balances to make sure. And one of those is investigation and punishment, right? So that seems to be what is completely lacking from the CIA's process right now. They may have written a 200-page manual, hired psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, they worked with the FBI, they worked with all sorts of informants, but they didn't set up any sort of checks and balances to say, we wrote that you can't strip someone naked and put them in a room if the room is below 86 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just sort of farcical. But even if, you're going to follow that, how are you going to check it? I mean, who's going to check? Who's it on to check? And what example have you set that if you don't follow that, then, you're going to be in trouble? So to me, that's really the main difference. I mean, I don't see any sort of fantastical James Bond techniques, being introduced. I thought the Inspector General's report sort of detailed some very brutish techniques, but they weren't, extraordinarily shocking. They weren't anything that you had never seen in a movie. And then furthermore, you had multiple attestations from people in the CIA and, interrogators from other agencies that were working with them that said, none of this worked.
Let me ask you a question in at this point. If we've seen pictures of these documents, and we know that it's that some of the stuff in it is pretty terrible. We're going to get your mother and rape her in front of you, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And then there's a whole lot redacted. If they allowed that sort of thing out, what the hell is there that's been redacted that's so awful?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, and one of the, I think that's a great point, because one of the most sort of resounding criticisms that's already come out is that the author of the report is furious that the one section that is 100% blacked out is the recommendations section. So you have no idea what, you know, an internal investigation recommended that the agency do to itself. And that would be exactly the sort of things that, you know, we were just talking about, which is, you know, instituting checks and balances and instituting, you know, a precedent for how to control this kind of behavior, this kind of, you know, aberrant behavior that's completely unacceptable.
Well,
so,
we have no idea.
We
know there are bad people in all segments of society and in the military and all that. Is there a good psychological screening that goes on here to keep these sadistic personalities out?
No, not that I know of, certainly not in the military that I know of, but I'm not sure that you could predict it. You know, I'm sure you've spoken to veterans, and, you know, I think Clint Eastwood has done some film work to this effect, but, you know, people behave strangely, and sometimes even outside their own moral boundaries, when they're in combat or when they're in very intense situations like that. So one of the cases that I was looking at today is, I think his name was Lieutenant Colonel West. He's the Army colonel who fired a pistol next to an Iraqi detainee's head to get him to confess. He was, you know, demoted, kicked out of the Army, and fined, you know, and his career is over, essentially. So that was one of the examples of sort of what has to happen. But he said himself, you know, that I look back on that incident, and I don't really know what I was doing. I know what my motivation was, but I'm not sure that I would have done that in a particularly rational state of mind. But that's exactly why you need very clear-cut boundaries and you need checks and balances. It's because people are going to do unanticipated things, and that's why you need a check. And you want to check on that, right? I've been there. I've been downrange. I've been surrounded by the enemy, literally. You know, the base that we were on in the first year of the war in Iraq, outside of Fallujah, was enemy territory, right? And so, you know, the ridiculous ticking time bomb scenario that everyone keeps padding around, well, I lived that for a year. I mean, we literally got blown up every day. So there was literally a bomb waiting every day, right? And I know the pressure that puts on you. But that's, you know, I know from personal experience, though, that's why you want checks on yourself, right? Because you're so driven and you're so motivated and you're so convinced that someone knows something and that if you can just get it from them, then you're going to save lives. I mean, that's an incredibly motivating sense, and it will drive you to do all sorts of things that you would never consider doing before, which is precisely why you have to have someone, either your training or your supervisors or your colleagues or an outside body, checking on you to make sure that, you know, you're staying on the straight and narrow. And then lastly, you have to have some moral sense of compunction, right? If you don't have a personal sense of where you belong and what your responsibility is, both to yourself and to other human beings, then you're completely lost. And I think that's where the CIA has really lost its way, or at least some of the people within the CIA that are arguing that, you know, anything goes. That's the only thing that separates you from a terrorist, right, is your behavior.
Sure.
Right, it's why you do what you do. So, you know, why would you want to give that up? You know, I read all these comments, you know, for every one of these articles that comes out. And, you know, there's definitely a segment of the population that still believes that, you know, for a certain type of individual who is just sort of, you know, all bad, this prototypical evil terrorist who wants to, you know, blow up the world and take it down with him, that anything goes, that there's no technique that's, you know, too abhorrent to use. But they're mistaken, right, because they don't understand that not only does that technique not work, right, but that you have to separate what you feel like someone deserves, right, personally, right? You can't hate Timothy McVeigh. We didn't torture him. We convicted him in a court of law, and we executed him. That's the way we do it. Right, whatever he deserved, we didn't torture him. So whatever the, you know, you personally think these guys deserve, you have to separate that from what you want to do, which is get what they know out of their head. And you know, the only analogy that I've ever been able to come up with is that, you know, interrogating someone is like picking a lock. Right, it's a very delicate process. You're poking around in the dark. You can't always see, and you're leveraging different things off one another until finally you hear that click, and the lock turns. And if you torture someone, it's like taking a sledgehammer to that lock, right? I mean, you are just going to absolutely destroy it. And there is absolutely no guarantee that when you take a sledgehammer to that lock to get inside his brain, that you're not going to destroy what's in there. So you can really defeat yourself in 100 different ways, whether it's ethically or, you know, effectively extracting intelligence by reverting to those kinds of behaviors.
Oh, sure. Have you heard, oddly enough, when you were talking about there's no way to predict who's going to be, through profiling, who's going to be the person that might do this sort of thing or not. I participated in a psychological experiment in college called the Milgram experience. Are you familiar with that?
Maybe, but I don't remember the details.
What they did was they put you in a room, and there was an adjacent room, and they had a control panel in front of you, and they told you that they had somebody wired up on the other side to an electrical charge, and you had control of it. And
yeah, I heard about this.
Yeah.
Please tell me how the rest of it goes.
And I was involved in this, and so they said, ask the gentleman on the other side a question, and if he gets it right, do nothing. If he gets the answer wrong, push this button and shock him. And it's a low voltage. Don't worry about it. I'm in charge. So you go in a room and you do this, and the guy gets a couple of questions right, and then he gets one wrong, and he says, okay, shock him. So you hit the button, and you hear him on the other end, in the other room. You can't see the guy. And you hear the guy in the other room go, oh. So he just got a slight jolt. And so you keep going and going and going, and finally, after he misses a half dozen questions or so, you push the button to shock him, and you hear him over there going, ow, ow, oh, God, that hurts. And then you know, if you're me, you look at the guy in charge of this who's wearing a white coat and holding a notepad, and he says, don't worry, I'm in charge. You are under no, it's not your responsibility, it's mine, do what I tell you. So I go on a couple more, and finally I shock the guy once, and he yells, and it scares me. I'm thinking, I'm really hurting this guy, and I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to hurt somebody in that other room. I don't care what you say. I'm not going to do it. And so I got up, and I left. Well, it turns out my best friend that went with me on this experiment, he shocked the guy until the guy supposedly passed out. He screamed and screamed and screamed, and the next time he shocked him, there was no response. To make a long story short, you know, the answer is there was nobody hooked up on the other side, but
right.
You thought there was, and they were trying to find out who would and who would not follow orders to the point where you'd kill somebody and if you didn't think the responsibility was yours. And it turns out I wouldn't do it. Turns out my best friend would. But they came to the conclusion during that experiment, and I'm sorry to go on and on about this, but they came to the conclusion they really could not tell who would and who would not go through with this.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. It's really interesting that you would bring up that same point, because going back to the interrogator training that you get with the military, one of the first points that they drive home, along with your knowledge of the Geneva Convention and the rules of land warfare, is that one of the rights that you have as a subordinate soldier, as a lower ranking soldier, is to refuse an unlawful order. Right, which is, sort of the version of what you did by refusing to do what the gentleman in the lab coat told you. You know, he represents a position of authority and expertise, and normally you would defer to that. But there's a certain point at which, you have to follow your own moral compass. And I'm just really surprised to see, some of the excuses that were noted in this Inspector General's report. Folks said, well, we got, vehement emails from Washington, D.C., and we felt we had to keep going. And we got urgent phone calls. And I just, I can't imagine being in a black ops prison somewhere in Thailand, halfway around the world, and getting an urgent email, and feeling compelled to waterboard someone another 50 times. I mean, I just don't understand where the resistance went away, the resistance to doing something that you knew wasn't right. Because concurrent with you know, these urgings from D.C. were equal urgings from the folks who were downrange saying, you know, this isn't working. We don't need to do this anymore.
Well, what if it's a total, what if it's a total sociopath on the other end of the phone?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you read this stuff and it really, you know, lays it out in detail sort of how the techniques are supposed to be implemented, and, you know, it's supposedly vetted by doctors and psychiatrists, you know, to push you to the very limit but without leaving, you know, permanent psychological or physical scars. I mean, you just, you can't come to any other conclusion that, that, you know, they just found some sadist medical professionals. And in fact, you know, that's two of the guys who are sort of right now credited with coming up with the enhanced interrogation techniques. Is two former SEER instructors, Search, Evasion, Rescue, and Escape instructors from the Special Forces School that were hired as private contractors by the CIA. And they're the ones who actually came up with, you know, a lot of these techniques. They're not, you know, trained interrogators. They're not intelligence professionals. They were two psychiatrists who were hired by that school to make sure that the training that we put Special Forces soldiers and pilots through in the event that they were captured to, you know, teach them to survive and resist.
Did you have much experience with any of these private contractors? Are they the bunch of cowboys in most cases that we're hearing about?
You know, I don't know. I mean, that's definitely, there is a precedent for that. So the one CIA contractor that's been convicted was for the beating of the Afghani man with a flashlight and kicked him, and he died of his wounds the next day. And that guy was tried and convicted. And it seems like a lot of the people who were involved in some of these harsher interrogations were contractors. But, you know, the details of that may very well be the, you know, the pages and pages that are blacked out. And they refer very obliquely in their report to, you know, people have said, or an officer told us, or an agent told me, and that kind of thing. So I don't know. That may be certainly a factor, but it doesn't preclude, you know, someone from within the agency being responsible either.
What do you think?
It's the real conundrum.
Where do you think it's going to go? What's your opinion?
I don't know where it's going to go, but it's got to go somewhere, right? I mean, the only redeeming thing in situations like this, you know, whether it's our, you know, trial at Nuremberg after the conclusion of World War II, whether it's the, you know, the trial and investigation after the My Lai massacre, you know, the only thing that clears the air here is transparency and accountability and an open and legal judicial process. I mean, that's the only thing that can possibly rectify something like this long term. And so I think that's what's got to happen. I mean, I think this investigation has to go forward, and I really just hope they follow the breadcrumbs.
No matter where it goes?
This stuff has been out there. Right? When's this report from? 2004? And it's, you know, had front page news in 2009? So I don't know what else is out there. You know, what's the redacted portions? But I don't see the long-term for us as a nation, for this administration, for the previous administration, or for our intelligence collection capabilities right now in, you know, brushing this aside. It just doesn't seem like it's going to go away. You know, Abu Ghraib broke years ago, and it's still a topic of discussion. Guantanamo Bay, you know, just now made a decision to move forward from that, but, you know, it comes up again every couple of months. So it's like a bad virus. And if we don't, you know, really root out, I think it's going to spread like a cancer. You know, I think it's going to undermine anything we do in the name of national security.
Well,
if we don't prove some sort of accountability.
Yeah, we hear from in political circles that, well, you know, we can't for the good of secrecy and our national security and all that, we can't let all of this get out. And if it did get up and knock on the door of the vice president or all that, we can't, for national security reasons and for political reasons, we just can't go there. Do you agree with that? I frankly don't. I don't care where it would lead. I would prosecute.
No, they said the same thing about Nixon, right?
Yes.
That we couldn't possibly, you know, that it would ruin the nation and mm-hmm. derail everything, and, you know, Vietnam would fall apart, and we couldn't possibly. I mean, he was the president, after all. You know, you can't possibly do that. But I think you have to. I mean, that's your, you know, that's your moral obligation in upholding the law. So, you know, I don't have it out. I don't have a personal, you know, vendetta for anyone in any particular, you know, position. I know plenty of, you know, former friends and colleagues and, you know, former co-students at various places that, you know, that work for these agencies and organizations, and they're, you know, really dedicated, hardworking people. So, you know, it's a discredit to them not to, you know, do this objectively and to the fullest extent. I don't think you have to go after anyone. I think the facts are there. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem like a great effort for this inspector to have compiled this information. You know, I don't think that he had to really pull any strings. I think he just talked to people.
Sure.
And the evidence was there. So I don't see really what the problem with that is.
John, you're an interrogator. Did you see any merit in enhanced interrogation procedures?
None whatsoever. Absolutely not. And I can give you two very specific quick examples why. One is Iranian prisoners. So I would get in through the prison. I mean, we processed anywhere from, you know, 20 to 70 guys a week for a full year. Sometimes we have prison populations over 100. So I saw scars on their people, on the backs of their ears, in the private parts. And I quickly learned to completely disregard those guys. At first, I thought they were great because I could literally just look at them crosswise, and they would break down. You know, they would cry or beg to be released and tell me anything I wanted to know, any of the questions that I just could not get anyone else to answer. All of a sudden, these guys had...
We're breaking up a little bit on the phone, John. Are you still with us?
Sorry.
Okay, we're breaking up.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
So these guys had been in Iranian prisons. They'd been tortured, and their brains were basically scrambled eggs. They
wow.
were so petrified of being imprisoned and tortured again that they would say anything, and they were completely unreliable. Right. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I saw guys who had never been to jail, who'd never been in trouble, never been arrested. But again, when we're doing these medical screenings, I would see scars, you know, the size and depth of which I just never saw, you know, anywhere in the military, in sports, in car accidents, forget it. I mean, these guys had nasty, nasty scars. And I asked one of them, you know, he looked like he had a Christmas tree on his back of scars. And I was like, where did you get this? And he's like, my brother. My brother beat me with a cable because I didn't do what he said. And right then and there, you know, I did the math. Because if this guy's brother, his own brother, beat him like that and did things to him like that, and he's concurrently lived under a regime that was known for kidnapping people or, you know, taking people out, destroying entire villages, there is nothing that I was willing to do to push the limit, you know, waterboarding, whatever they call these stupid things, the attention slap, the net grab, whatever you want to sanitize it with, you're beating the guy up. I would never be able to do anything to these guys that their own people or that their own experience hadn't already prepared them to do.
Ooh,
right? I mean, these guys are just, they're tough. So that's not going to work. What works is talking to them, understanding them, making them believe that you know more than them. That's what works. So I see no merit, and I see no testimony from anyone with any operational credibility that has ever said that this stuff works. It's only far-removed representatives and high-ranking officials who make oblique references to this lie. And then when you ask them which lie, they can't answer. And that's in the report, too. It says there's not one circumstance in this 300-page report where we can say this so-called enhanced interrogation technique yielded
interest. Begs the question, why was Mr. Cheney so adamant that he wanted this report released so people could see how much great intelligence we got from these enhanced interrogation methods?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, but you know, I haven't heard from him lately. So
no, we have not. And he was just. I think he said that because he didn't actually think they would be released.
Well, great. What do they call that in Congress? They call it a free vote or something.
Yeah.
You know, the bill is going to get killed and go for it anyway.
Right. That had to be it because there's nothing actionable. We've seen, come out of this.
No.
John, I want to reserve the right to have you back on again some of these days. This is a fascinating subject, and we've been caught up today in the death of one of our most renowned senators that we've ever had. We've been covering that pretty much on the program today, but you've given us great insight into this very timely story.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on, and we're going to be talking a lot more about this in the future, and we'll get back to you as things go along.
That'd be great. I'd be happy to do it.
John McCary, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
And you do know that Mr. Cheney said, yes, let's release these reports. And really great information out of it. Yes, that's what he said. I know. Break here, but what I think we want to do is Denver, Colorado. 1 year ago today, and I heard this speech that gave me chills. And it was given by a man whom you know I highly respect. And it was such an honor and such a pleasure to be there for that speech that I want to play it for you now. And it backs some memories to all of you. Mr. Ted Kennedy at the Democratic National Convention 1 year ago today.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much. Hey, Chip. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Caroline. My fellow Democrats, my fellow Americans, it is so wonderful to be here. And nothing is going to keep me away from this special gathering tonight. I have come here tonight to stand with you, to change America, to restore its future, to rise to our best ideals, and to elect Barack Obama President of the United States. As I look ahead, I am strengthened by family and friendship. So many of you have been with me in the happiest days and the hardest days. Together we have known success and seen setbacks, victory and defeat. But we have never lost our belief that we are all called to a better country and a newer world. And I pledge to you that I will be there next January on the floor of the United States Senate when we begin the great fight. For me, this is a season of hope. New hope for a justice and fair prosperity for the many and not just for the few. New hope. And this is the cause of my life. New hope that we will break the old gridlock and guarantee that every American, north, south, east, west, young, old, will have decent, quality health care as a fundamental right and not a privilege. We can meet these challenges with Barack Obama. Yes, we can, and finally, yes, we will. Barack Obama will close the book on the old politics of race, gender, and group against group, and straight against gay. And Barack Obama will be a commander-in-chief who understands that young Americans in uniform must never be committed to a mistake, but always to a mission worthy of their bravery. We are told that Barack Obama believes too much in an America of high principle and bold endeavor. But when John Kennedy thought of going to the moon, he didn't say, it's too far to get there. We shouldn't even try. Our people and rose to the challenge. And today, an American flag still marks the surface of the moon. Yes, we are all Americans. This is what we do. We reach the moon. We scale the heights. I know it. I've seen it. I've lived it. And we can do it again. There is a new wave of change all around us. And if we set our compass true, we will reach our destination. Not merely victory for our party, but renewal for our nation. And this November, the torch will be passed again to a new generation of Americans. So with Barack Obama, and for you, and for me, our country will be committed to his cause. The work begins anew. The hope rises again, and the dream lives on.
Ah, yes, Ted Kennedy, still the one. He may have left us in body, but certainly not in spirit. A man whom thinking Americans will have fond memories of forever. I know I will. And all the hate that's being spewed today about Ted Kennedy, those people can all go straight to hell as far as I'm concerned, and probably will. How they could spew this terrible hatred against this man is, it's beyond me. But then again, you know what we're dealing with there. We're dealing with people that aren't able to think for themselves. And we've proven that over and over again. After all, 54% of them believe, of the Fox people, believe that the government has no control over Medicare. So let's just let that speak for us. Right now, I want to play what I consider to be one of the most moving things that I've ever heard in my life. And here we have the youngest brother talking about the passing of the middle brother, the famous eulogy that Ted Kennedy gave at Bobby's funeral.
There is discrimination in this world, and slavery and slaughter and starvation. Governments repress their people. Millions are trapped in poverty while the nation grows rich and wealth is lavished on armaments everywhere. These are differing evils, but they are the common works of man. They reflect the imperfection of human justice, the inadequacy of human compassion, our lack of sensibility towards the suffering of our fellows. But we can perhaps remember, even if only for a time, those who live with us are our brothers, that they share with us the same short moment of life, that they seek, as we do, nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and happiness, winning what satisfaction and fulfillment they can. Sure, common faith, this bond of common goal, can begin to teach us something. Surely we can learn, at least to look at those around us as fellow men. And surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and to become in our own hearts brothers and countrymen once again. The answer is to rely on you. Not a time of life, but a state of mind, a temper of the will, a quality of imagination, a predominance of courage over timidity, of the appetite for adventure over the love of ease. The cruelties and obstacles of this swiftly changing planet will not yield to the obsolete dogmas and outworn slogans. They cannot be moved by those who cling to a present that is already dying, the illusion of security to the excitement and danger that come with even the most peaceful progress. It is a revolutionary world we live in, and this generation at home and around the world has had thrust upon it a greater burden of responsibility than any generation that has ever lived. Some believe there is nothing one man or one woman can do against the enormous array of the world's ills. Yet many of the world's great movements of thought and action have flowed from the work of a single man. A young monk began the Protestant Reformation. A young general extended an empire from Macedonia to the borders of the earth. A young woman reclaimed the territory of France. And it was a young Italian explorer who discovered the New World, and the 32-year-old Thomas Jefferson who reclaimed that all men are created equal. These men move the world, and so can we all. Few will have the greatness to bend history itself, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events. And in the total of all those acts will be written the history of this generation. Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. And crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. Few are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, the wrath of their society. Moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Yet it is the one essential, vital quality for those who seek to change a world that yields most painfully to change. And I believe that in this generation, those with the courage to enter the moral conflict find themselves with companions in every corner of the globe. For the fortunate among us, there is the temptation to follow the easy and familiar paths of personal ambition and financial success, so grandly spread before those who enjoy the privilege of education. But that is not the road history has marked out for us. Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty. But they are also more open to the creative energy of men than any other time in history. All of us will ultimately be judged. And as the years pass, we will surely judge ourselves on the effort we have contributed to building a new world society and the extent to which our ideals and goals have shaped that event. Our future may lie beyond our vision, but it is not completely beyond our control. It is the shaping impulse of America that neither fate nor nature nor the irresistible ties of history, but the work of our own hands, matched to reason and principle, that will determine our destiny. There is pride in that, even arrogance, but there is also experience and truth. In any event, it is the only way we can live. That is the way he lives. That is what he needs us. My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. He'll be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times, in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say why. I dream things that never were and say why not.
And so, it's time for another eulogy for another great man. I don't know who will give that eulogy. It's hard to say. I don't know what the eulogy will say. But I can certainly cite many things it should say and will say. This is a sad time for many of us. We'll grieve. We'll remember Ted Kennedy and the great things that he's done. We'll remember him as an extraordinary human being. A man who didn't have to care for those that were not at his station, but did. Out of just love and compassion for his fellow human being. He had nothing to gain personally by being in the United States Senate. He had nothing to gain personally by getting fame and power. He had that when he was born. He watched most of his family die. An extraordinarily difficult life in that respect. And suffered human tragedies himself, physically. But he stayed upright, and he fought for what was right, always. And he will always be remembered for that. We grieve over his death, but we also rejoice over his life. That's the way we'll remember Ted Kennedy. For the wonderful things he's done for the people of the United States. God bless Ted Kennedy and his family. You're listening to The Guy James Show and the Head On Radio Network. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Tomorrow.